No war in human history has been a perfect contest between good and evil. There are always arguments on both sides of any dispute. And wars, like people, contain good guys and bad guys on both sides, at least most of the time and at least throughout most of history. The great exception, in most respects, not all, but most respects, seems to be World War II, when Western democracies were pitched against some of the foulest regimes in all of human history. We've mentioned this several times on this show, and we featured several World War II episodes because they present such a contrast between authoritarian government on the one side and constitutional democracy on the other. So here's another one, based upon, yep, you guessed it, my recent visit to Europe with my son, Ben. And today, it's all about the Battle of Britain and the Battle for Normandy. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional, and it's all about World War II.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
What General Vagon called the Battle of France is over. I expect that the Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization. Upon it depends our own British life and the long continuity of our institutions and our empire. The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be free, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us, therefore, brace ourselves to our duties, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
Did you recognize that speech? Yep, you guessed it. It was Winston Churchill. It was June of 1940, and he was speaking to his countrymen, and indeed the whole world, about the fact that Britain now stood alone against the Nazi onslaught. You see, France had just fallen. The Maginot Line had proved a chimera. There was nothing between Hitler and the United States except the British fleet, and there was nothing at all between Hitler and Britain. This is when Churchill made his famous speech. Recently, my son Ben and I, who's a student at the University of Virginia, were in Europe in large part to do a research project of his on the end of World War II, the beginning of the Cold War. And we went to a number of interesting sites having to do with those subjects. And perhaps our favorite, I mean, there were lots of favorites, but perhaps our favorite was a visit one day to the Royal Air Force Museum in a northern suburb of London, where we had an absolutely wonderful time, and I'll let Ben start the story.
Well, I think the most immediate thing you notice going into the RAF Museum is just the planes themselves. They have, like, the actual planes that, you know, fought in the Battle of Britain. They have, of course, Hurricanes and Spitfires. They have more modern planes. They have enormous bombers. I mean, it's pretty fantastic.
It really is. It comprises several hangars that cover several acres, if I recall correctly.
Sure, and they actually, they'll occasionally go out and fly the planes, too. They put on air shows of old planes. You know, some of the planes, not just replicas, but that actually fought in World War II.
That is actually absolutely remarkable. I didn't realize that when we were there. I mean, some of the planes we actually saw on the floor of the museum, they'll take out and fly them around sometimes?
I don't know if any of the planes that we saw on the museum floor, but they definitely mentioned that they had planes and reserve hangars that they used for air shows.
Okay, now I understand.
They built them right.
What was your favorite part of the RAF Museum?
Well, I guess, I mean, they had a lot of cool exhibits. One of my favorites was they had a really interesting exhibit on the dam buster bombs that were used, where they had these bombs that were dropped into lakes and actually skipped across the surface of the water before landing at a dam, rolling and blowing it up. A really remarkable feat of human engineering. But I think my favorite part was a lot of the description of the Battle of Britain.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, it's the RAF Museum in London, and it's very much phrased in terms of, you know, a national struggle. It's very patriotic. A bunch of, you know, excerpts from Churchill's speeches, you know, this was our finest hour, the empire will remember for thousands of years. But specifically the fact that, you know, a lot of the times we tend to attribute British success in the Battle of Britain to superior technology and radar, but also the valor and fighting ability of the RAF. And I think one of the things I learned there was that a lot of the reason Britain prevailed in that battle was because of a huge strategic error on the part of the Nazis and Hitler specifically.
Oh, really? What was that?
Well, during the opening phases of the Battle of Britain, Goring and the Luftwaffe concentrated on the military infrastructure of the RAF. They bombed radar towers, they bombed airfields, and the British were losing airfields faster than they could build them, and the same for radio towers. And they were really on the ropes, especially considering the, you know, the woeful state of preparedness before the Second World War. But Hitler decided, in part for in retaliation for a strike on Berlin, to shift the Battle of Britain to the cities. And he, you know, he ordered the Luftwaffe to, instead of attacking airfields, to start, you know, bombing London itself. And while, of course, this was a terrible tragedy for, you know, innocent civilians in London, and began, you know, a campaign of strategic bombing that would eventually result in the destruction of many German cities, it saved the RAF, who were on the brink of defeat, because they actually, they, you know, they had the ability to repair their infrastructure, and instead of fighting for their survival, they were fighting still over their skies, but not for their own survival. And it was really a dumb decision on the Nazis' part, and a huge miscalculation, because instead of, you know, demoralizing the British public, it really reinforced the notion that this was a total war.
Yeah, yeah, and they actually had the two great British planes of that struggle were the Spitfire and the Hurricane, and I seem to recall they had actual models of both of them there, didn't they?
Yeah, right outside.
Do you have a favorite between the two?
I feel bad for saying so, because the Hurricane always gets a bad rap, but it's got to be the Spitfire.
Yes.
I mean, it's easily the most beautiful plane, I think. I've ever seen, at least.
Yeah, I seem to recall there was a Spitfire suspended from the atrium in the Imperial War Museum as well.
It's tough. My patriotic fervor makes me think of the good qualities of the Mustang, but I mean, the Spitfire, it's a thing of beauty.
Yeah, the B-51 Mustang may have been the best fighter of World War II, but the Spitfire, far and away, the most beautiful. Okay, well, thanks, Ben. I appreciate your input there. It was a great trip, wasn't it?
Well, my traveling companion was terrible, but other than that, it's a good time.
Okay.
Thanks, Ben. I appreciate the vote of confidence. One of the best things that happened to the two of us at the RAF Museum was that we ran into a fellow by the name of George Greenfield. Now, George was the tour guide there. He's a volunteer tour guide, and he gave the tour on the Lancaster bomber, which was the big, heavy bomber that the Brits used during most of the war, where they did their nighttime bombing. And he gave a wonderful tour right there with a Lancaster bomber in front of us, and he told us about the famous dam buster missions and all sorts of other really cool stuff. He was so knowledgeable and so articulate that I asked him at the conclusion of it, well, I told him about this radio show, and I pulled out my handy pocket recorder, and I asked him if he'd tell us the story of the Battle of Britain, and with great alacrity, he agreed. Oh, before we begin, actually, let me just mention that the RAF Museum, as you might guess, is in a great big hangar. You have to. You know, there are airplanes there, and it's cavernous, and there are lots of echoes. And unfortunately, we didn't have it all to ourselves. There were other visitors, including a couple of babies who just seemed to be following us around and periodically screaming. I'm sorry about that, but at least the babies are screaming in English accents.
France fell in May 1940, and France was the major, I suppose, the major European military power opposed to Germany at the outbreak of war. France fell in 1940 after the so-called Blitzkrieg.
Right, which and that was such a shock because they were considered to be the great land power.
Correct, that's right. The truth is that the French had invested in a passive defensive system, the Maginot Line, and the the psychological effect of this was to make them, I think...
Well, obviously we have a baby nearby who's very upset by the Maginot Line.
Yes, indeed.
All right. And I find it a very upsetting concept as well. All right, but go on, please.
Anyway, France fell. That left England on its own in late May 1940. And there was quite a powerful body of opinion in the British government, led by Lord Halifax, which actually favoured coming to some sort of deal with Hitler. But Churchill...
And the historical evidence suggests that Hitler might have been willing to do so. Now, it would not have been a pleasant deal. But, I mean, there was some basis for that. We tend to look back on it and say, well, of course, that would have been horrible. It never would have worked. But there's some basis for thinking Halifax had an argument, didn't he?
Oh, yes. But he certainly did. I mean, Hitler had no plan, had no desire to fight the United Kingdom. He regarded the British, as well, not exactly allies, but as cousins, but as essentially...
Rassenbrüder, the race brothers.
Yes.
So you were racially acceptable.
Correct, yes.
Right.
Yes, we weren't Slavs or Jews or any... Or Untermenschen.
Right.
Of any description. So yes, but Churchill was determined, and I think correctly, and I think he had the country with him. Churchill understood, I think almost instinctively, that the Nazis were not simply a rather unpleasant government, but actually something far worse than that, and that Britain really was the last hope of the free world to carry the torch. If Britain was conquered, then that was it. The whole of Europe would be...
It would have been very, very hard for Canada and the United States and the rest of the Commonwealth to come to Britain's aid after it had fallen.
I think practically impossible.
Yeah, actually. Really. Really so. Okay, so that brings us to your area of expertise, and you lead tours in the Battle of Britain. Give us the brief version, will you?
Sure, I will. The battle is supposed to have started in July, and it's supposed to finish in October. So it was quite a short episode. It divides into various phases, but mainly the objective on the British side was to maintain the RAF as a force in being. Once the RAF was destroyed, once the Luftwaffe established air superiority over the south of England. The Royal Navy would be powerless to prevent an invasion fleet from landing its troops, because dive bombers and, in fact, conventional bombers would easily be able to destroy the warships of the Royal Navy. So, even though a revisionist view nowadays is that the invasion wouldn't have taken place even if the RAF had been defeated, because the Royal Navy would always have been too strong.
Really, I didn't have without air cover.
Without air cover,
air cover had been demonstrated years before as essential. I mean, land-based aircraft could always destroy.
And I take this view. You only have to see what happened in the Mediterranean,
right,
in 1941 to realize that the Royal Navy could never have successfully beaten off an invasion without air superiority by the RAF. So the RAF basically had to remain as a force in being. The Luftwaffe's objective was not actually initially to bomb London. This was almost an afterthought. The Luftwaffe's objective was to actually destroy the RAF as an effective defensive force. Their chosen method of doing this at the outset was to attack convoys. Channel convoys were important as a means of moving supplies from one part of the UK to another. Obviously, things like coal, raw materials for industry, and so on and so forth. So they were obviously important to defend. And the Luftwaffe believed that if they attacked these, that the RAF would be forced to come up and defend them. Well, the RAF did defend them to some degree, but they husbanded their forces quite cleverly.
Were they really attacking the convoys, or were they trying to lure the Spitfires and Hurricanes out?
Well, both, but mainly the latter. Mm-hmm. The next step was to attack the radar stations, which they didn't fully understand the significance of, but they could see them,
right,
and clearly they were an important part of the defensive system. So they were the next to be attacked, and they were attacked by Stuka dive bombers, which had been very successful in the Blitzkrieg. Unfortunately, the Stukas were decimated by the Hurricanes and Spitfires of the defensive force, and that proved abortive. So the next German strategy was to actually attack the airfields in the south of England. So that was, if you like, phase three of the battle.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. This week it's all about World War II, defending democracy from the Nazis. And we've been speaking with George Greenfield. who has been telling us about the Battle of Britain. George is a tour guide at the RAF Museum in London. Isn't he fantastic? After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and we'll come back and finish up our discussion with George Greenfield. But we got lots more, so stay tuned. Well, sports fans, it's time for our game. We call it our constitutional quiz. And, of course, the pitcher who comes up on the mound is our own quiz guy, Doug Smith. How are you, Doug?
Casey to the bat.
Casey, yeah, well, the contestant is Casey to the bat. You are the pitcher. You're the guy in charge.
Oh, nice, nice.
Absolutely.
Nice.
You like to think that way, don't you?
I you know what? It's the first time I've even thought about baseball in a long time.
Indeed. I like baseball.
Yeah?
But that's because I'm old.
Yeah,
It's true. I think it's one of those generational things. Most people my kids' age, they don't even know what baseball is.
I've seen the game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get back to the Constitution. Doug, do you have a riddle for us today, or do you have a multiple-choice question, or what?
No, we have a question today.
A question with multiple choice, and do we have a contestant?
Yeah,
we do.
Laney,
where are you from, Laney?
Raleigh, North Carolina.
That is a great town.
I love it.
There's lots and lots of politics down there, isn't there?
Yes, definitely.
Well, right now we're not going to get political, but we will get constitutional. So, Doug, do you have a question? You ready for Laney?
I do. Laney, are you ready?
Yes, I am.
I'm going to read the question. I'm going to give you four choices. Get ready.
Okay.
Who was the oldest delegate at the Constitutional Convention? Was it A, Ben Franklin? B, Thomas Jefferson? C, James Madison, or D, John Witherspoon?
Ooh, that, you see, it sounded easier up to that point.
Who was the oldest delegate to the Constitutional Convention? Was it A, Ben Franklin, B, Thomas Jefferson, C, James Madison, or D, John Witherspoon?
That's a tough one, Laney.
Yes.
Can you eliminate any of those choices?
Not really, because I don't know anybody's age.
Oh, okay. Well, gosh.
I feel like some were younger than others, but not quite for sure.
Well, you're going to have to pick somebody. Can you just think of pictures you might have seen of them? Maybe that'll give you a clue.
Maybe C, John Madison?
You think John Madison or James Madison?
James Madison.
James Madison. You think he was the oldest one there?
Yes.
All right. That's because you've seen pictures of him looking old?
Maybe. Hopefully.
Well, he did get old. In fact, I think he didn't die until he was in his 80s, right?
Yeah, he lasted a long time. In fact, he was the last of the signers of the Constitution to actually die.
He was the last one, but that conversely indicates that maybe he was among the last, or he was the last, because at the time of the convention, he was actually...
One of the youngest.
I'm sorry, Laney.
Well,
he was one of the youngest ones.
The youngest was Jonathan Dayton of New Jersey.
Who was like in his 20s,
right? 26 years old.
Good heavens.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that's too young to be crafting a country.
I probably so, which is why it's probably the first time anyone's ever heard of him right now as you speak his name.
When I was 26, I could barely, you know, pull together a meal, much less the balance of power.
I could go to McDonald's when I was 26. I'd figured that out by then.
Okay, so it's not James Madison, Laney. We're going to give you another shot at this. Is it Ben Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, or John Witherspoon?
John Witherspoon.
John Witherspoon.
That's not bad.
It's not bad.
It's pretty good. John Witherspoon, of course, what is now known as Princeton.
Right. He was the president there. And he was actually James Madison's teacher Madison was there. So he was much older than Madison.
Yeah. He was like one of the guiding voices of the Scottish Enlightenment here in the United States.
He was.
And that was incredibly impactful on the way the founding happened.
It was.
Yeah. But it wasn't.
We're down to two, Laney. Who do you think it might be? Who we got left? Franklin and Jefferson, right?
Yeah, Franklin and Jefferson.
Okay, Laney?
Franklin.
You are correct.
Hey, she got it. Tremendous.
That is fantastic. Yeah.
Could have gone with my gut.
That's nice. All right. That's all right. That's why I was trying to give you that hint with the picture. If you look at your $100 bill, it's always a little frightening. because Ben Franklin didn't look too good in that picture, I always thought.
Yeah, you know, Franklin, he was in his low 80s, probably 81-ish.
Yeah, he was at the time of the convention.
He was so sick, though, at the convention, Laney. They actually had to get prisoners from the Walnut Street jail, and they would carry him in every day so that he could attend the convention. And at times, and even at the signing, he really couldn't sign his name. They had to help him sign his name.
Right.
On
well,
the,
he gave
the
he would sit. They brought in an upholstered chair for him to sit in.
A sedan chair.
And frequently he would kind of fall asleep during the middle, but he'd always wake up at important moments. And he gave a famous closing speech. But as you pointed out, Doug, he didn't actually give the speech himself. He couldn't stand for it, so he had a friend actually read his famous closing speech.
Yeah, he's racked in pain. He's got gout. You know,
kidney stones.
Yeah, I mean, but he was there.
He showed up.
And that's one of the things that makes the convention important, is you had people like Franklin there. You know, Franklin was part of a generation that launches, really, the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he is of that Declaration of Independence age.
Yep.
You know, he and Washington. If you hadn't had them in the room, the event itself wouldn't have had the weight required in order to have a lasting impact like it has today. Now
well,
we have a Constitution.
In the immortal words of Woody Allen, 80% of success is simply showing up. And Franklin showed up. So, Laney, you're going to get a T-shirt, because that was a tough question.
Okay, I still get the pocket constitution.
Oh, you always get a pocket constitution. We give those to anyone who participates because we want people to read the Constitution. But you'll also get a T-shirt, and we'll just send us an email at ywc@montpelier.org, MONTPELIER.ORG. Give us your T-shirt size, and we'll have one in the snail mail to you.
All right. Sounds great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Laney. And thank you, Doug.
You bet. Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And this week we're speaking about World War II, that great titanic struggle of good against evil, or at least I should say of Western constitutional democracies against the Nazis and other authoritarian regimes. We've been speaking most recently with George Greenfield, who is a volunteer guide at the Royal Air Force Museum just north of London, and he's been telling us the fascinating story of the Battle of Britain.
The third phase of the battle was the attack on the airfields, and actually at this point the Luftwaffe came closest to success, because this was mostly happening in August. And
August of 1940.
August of 1940, and throughout the month of August, if you examine the statistics of losses on both sides as the month wears on, you can see that at first the RAF are destroying considerably more Luftwaffe aircraft than they are losing themselves, but as the month wears on and as the attacks on the airfield intensify, it gets to parity, and then in some cases the RAF are losing more defending fighters than they're managing to destroy.
That's because the Germans had shifted their focus to the British airfields.
They're putting them under much more pressure, and they're starting to saturate the defences. And the pilots, bear in mind that there were only about 700 or 800 frontline pilots in the RAF at the beginning of the battle. The pilots are beginning to be tired. And in some cases, they're exhausted.
What was the average age of those pilots? Do you know off the top of your head?
It
was
early 20s.
Early 20s. That's remarkable.
I mean,
both my sons are in their early 20s.
If you were 25, you were an old man.
Wow. Okay. Please go on. Wow. So, that's remarkable.
That was true on both sides, actually.
Right.
So as August wears on, and towards the end of August, things are looking pretty grim for the defenders. And Keith Park, the commander of the RAF, is beginning to consider, you know, whether to actually withdraw, you know, north of London. And
seriously, pull the RAF back?
Get out of range of the ME-109s. It's the ME-109 that's doing most of the damage.
Right.
The ME-110 has proved not to be a particularly effective...
The ME-110 was the one that...
The twin engine.
Yeah, it actually looked almost like a bomber.
Well, it was meant to be a bomber escort, but it actually wasn't able to hold its own against the single-engined RAF fighters. So,
but the 109 is the one people typically think of when we think of a Messerschmitt fighter. Okay, that's the one that comes to mind. It's a single-engine plane.
Correct.
Right.
I mean, the 109 probably tied with the Spitfire in 1940 as the world's best single-engine fighter. Although the Hurricanes were more numerous on the RAF side, and it did in fact destroy the majority of
That's as good a point as any to ask the question, aircraft. Then. We always, of course, glorify the Spitfires. They're such a beautiful aircraft.
Indeed.
They really and truly are. but I've always understood that we're shortchanging the Hurricane planes and fighters as well. Now, they were less graceful, but I understand they were more heavily armored and armed, and they packed a bigger punch, didn't they?
The armament was exactly the same. The engine was exactly the same.
Well, then I don't know anything I'm talking about.
just to correct you.
Please do.
The main difference was the Hurricane was somewhat larger. Mm-hmm. The Hurricane was older technology. The Hawker Company, which were long-time suppliers to the RAF of fighter aircraft, quite wisely, in the circumstances, decided to stick with tried and tested technology, which meant basically a steel girder framework covered with plywood formers and fabric. Skinning.
That's interesting. So this plane that saw so much service in early in World War II had a fabric skin.
Yeah, the wings were metal, but the fuselage was mainly fabric.
Well, that sounds like World War I technology.
Correct. It was, in effect, World War I technology. It was developed World War I technology, and it was smart because the Hurricane was cheaper to produce. It was quicker to produce. It was easier to maintain, and most crucially of all, it was easier to repair. Mm-hmm. So because the RAF maintenance staff and fitters had 20 years' experience of maintaining and repairing this type of aircraft structure, they could do so on the bases, whereas the Spitfires, if they were damaged beyond a certain very, very trivial level, had to be sent away to be repaired, or new aircraft had to be supplied.
Is the great esteem that we give the Spitfire misplaced then? I mean, should we be respecting the Hurricane more?
The Spitfire had a higher performance, and that was the importance of that should not be underestimated. The Spitfire was the only Western world fighter that could fully hold its own in performance aspects with the ME-109.
So what are you talking about? Speed, maneuverability?
Speed, rate of climb, maneuverability, yes, all of these.
Okay.
Speed of dive also. Mm-hmm. The Hurricane was more maneuverable than either of them. It had a tighter turning circle than either of them. It was a better gun platform, certainly, than the Spitfire, even though it had the same armament.
Could you explain that? How was it better if the armament was the same?
The Spitfire had a very thin, high-speed wing, and the guns were distributed more or less evenly along the full length of the wing. If you look at the Mark I Spitfire that's actually in the Battle of Britain Hall to see this one has a cannon armament. It's a later model.
But I should mention we're standing right next to a Spitfire, but this is a later model. Okay,
yeah,
now I
is.
Understand. Okay,
it is. The Hurricane had the same eight rifle caliber machine gun armament, but they were in two closely concentrated batteries of four guns in each wing, and this meant that if you hit with one gun on the Hurricane, you were going to hit with at least four. Mm. Whereas with the Spitfire, if you hit with one gun, maybe that was all you hit with, because they were that much more spread out.
And this had to be distributed because of the airframe difference?
The airframe was the key thing.
Now I see.
The Hurricane had been designed in order to be a very robust, very easy to manufacture, very docile fighter. All of the air forces were dealing with the problems of converting from biplane fighters, which had been extant in the 20s and 30s, to monoplane fighters, which were being introduced in all the advanced air forces, including the US Air Force, the French Air Force, the German Air Force, the RAF, during the late 1930s. And one of the worries that that all the air forces had was how the pilots were actually going to adapt to something which was 100 miles an hour faster, mm-hmm. and landed at a higher speed and had generally more tricky handling qualities than the very docile, accommodating aircraft which they were accustomed to. So the Hurricane had been designed very much as being an easy step for biplane pilots into monoplanes. The Spitfire and the ME-109 were much more tightly focused on being pure performance, air superiority aircraft. That said, overall, the difference in 1940 between the then model of the Hurricane and the then model of the Spitfire was not very great.
Okay, maybe could fly both.
Pilots could fly both, and if you look at the top scoring 10 pilots in the RAF in the Battle of Britain, 5 flew Hurricanes, 5 flew Spitfires. And in fact, the top scoring pilot of all was a Hurricane pilot.
For heaven's sake. And
so,
in terms of shooting down German aircraft, which of the two aircraft did better?
The Spitfire did marginally better against ME-109s. The Hurricane did marginally better against bombers.
Okay.
But Hurricanes in the battle were responsible for the destruction of about 300 ME-109s.
Wow.
Out of this sort of 700 or so that were.
What was the relative percentage of Hurricanes and Spitfires?
About 3 to 2.
About 3 to 2.
At the beginning of the battle, and indeed all through the battle, there were 550 to 600 Hurricanes available and about 280 to 300 Spitfires.
Okay, well, we'd gotten into July, and you were telling me that things were starting to go south for the RAF because the Germans had started concentrating on the RAF airfields and infrastructure. What happened next?
Well, a useful accident. The RAF bomber force went to bomb Berlin. In those days, the bomber command was hardly capable of finding even a city-sized target at that range with their navigation techniques that they had, but they managed to actually drop some bombs on Berlin. I think one garden shed was destroyed and several people were injured. But most importantly, Adolf Hitler was incensed, was seized with fury, with rage, at the effrontery of the British to attack his capital. And it's worth bearing in mind also that Goering had promised that no bombs would ever fall on German soil, which was a typically bombastic undertaking.
So sort of a bombastic guy.
Yeah, he was a sort of bombastic guy.
He was.
So Hitler gave orders to Goering that the campaign was to be switched from the attack on the airfields to an attack on London. He said, right, well, what you do, you know, anything you can do, we can do 10 times better. So now you will reap the whirlwind.
I've always thought that was Hitler's first major military mistake.
Yes.
I mean, the next one, of course, was invading Russia, and then the third, declaring war on the U.S. when he didn't technically have to.
Yes.
Historians can debate all of that, but this always struck me as the first, because he really had the RAF on the ropes here.
Yes, that's correct.
And then he switched to the... Now, I have to ask you a little mythology. I'm sure you've seen the 1969 film Battle of Britain. They had a precursor incident. They said there was a German bomber that had a navigational error and dropped bombs on London, and that's what prompted the British raid on Berlin.
That's correct.
That actually did. Okay, yeah, so the way it happened was there was a navigational error.
Yeah, it was kind of tit for tat, yes.
Okay, and so the Germans first bombed London, so that's when Churchill sent over the mission to Berlin.
I don't think the German raid I'm not sure it was London. I think it was Coventry, actually. But it was a civilian target. It was a civilian target.
So that's what prompted the British to bomb Berlin,
yes.
And then that's what enraged Hitler. Okay, so the movie more or less got it right.
The movie was accurate, or at least faithful to the history in that respect.
I love that movie, by the way. I'm sure you do, too.
Oh, it's a great movie.
I've watched it about 18 times.
Yeah. I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that, I mean, the ME-109, the prototype flew with a Rolls-Royce engine, a Rolls-Royce Kestrel, and the Spanish Air Force 109s in the film were also Merlin-powered, Rolls-Royce-powered.
For heaven's sake.
So that was kind of symmetrical.
That's remarkable. I heard when that film was made, this is before, of course, computer graphics, they assembled so many vintage aircraft that were still airworthy that they had something like the sixth largest air force
in the world. I believe that's right.
Yes, exactly right. Now, this is the movie we're talking about now,
course.
And I just wanted to make sure. But that, so in your mind, is it, generally speaking, that movie is fairly accurate?
I think so, yes. I think it's pretty... There's some license, but by and large, it's accurate.
It has the ring of truth about it.
No, definitely.
Okay, but I keep digressing. So we're into July, things are going south, but then Hitler makes his great mistake. He orders bombing raids on London, tit for tat, reprisals. Did Goering, to your knowledge, did he object to this? Did he say, you know, Mein Führer, this is not a good idea?
No, I don't think he did. I think Goering's attitude was very much, you know, the Luftwaffe can do anything that it's called upon to do.
Resupply Stalingrad. Sorry, going on.
No, absolutely.
Right.
No, absolutely right.
Different battle, different year. Go on.
Sure. But by the end of August, I mean, the bombing campaign abruptly switched to London. And Churchill was delighted because he realized that although the Blitz was terrible, I mean, perhaps delighted is the wrong word, but they realized that London, or any major city for that matter, as indeed the Germans proved later on in the war, I mean, a major city can absorb a huge amount of damage before anything really serious happens. You have to bear in mind that London in those days was not much smaller than it is now. I mean,
it's huge.
We're talking about a vast area. Mm-hmm. Okay, there are key parts, the docks, there's industrial parts in the north, but nonetheless, it is an enormous target. And although the Blitz was effective in terms of doing damage, you know, it wasn't capable of either causing the British government to sue for peace or for materially damaging the war effort. I mean, it's a little-known fact that throughout the entire Battle of Britain, the United Kingdom was outproducing Germany in terms of fighter aircraft to a ratio of almost 2-1, and that went on. It wasn't affected.
The big limitation was aircrew, wasn't it?
The big limitation was aircrew.
And that's
indeed
where the Polish pilots...
The Polish pilots.
And a handful of Americans and Canadians... Well, Canadians and then a handful of American pilots.
Correct.
Came over
Billy
and helped
Fisk.
As well.
Billy Fisk was one of the American pilots who was...
New Zealand, Australia.
Yes.
A lot of Commonwealth pilots came in.
That's
right?
Correct. No, there were. I mean, there were 11 pilots from the Republic of Ireland, which was, strictly speaking, neutral.
Yes. Well, that's interesting.
And, well, these guys had all joined the RAF in the 30s, mainly to play rugby.
Well, now they had their chance. Now they had their chance to really, really get up in the air. Okay, so we got to get into August then.
So the bombing campaign on London was a very difficult thing for the Luftwaffe for various reasons. The main reason was range. London is further away than the south of England, obviously, from the airfields mostly in France that were being used to launch the attacks. And why was this important? Well, it was important because the ME-109's functional range, if you like, effective range, more or less allowed for about 10 to 15 minutes flying time over the Greater London area, and then or even less than that if you had to use full throttle in combat for any length of time. So what it meant basically was that the escort had to turn back or could not be fully effective in terms of protecting the bombers all the way to the target and all the way back again.
So is that when the British jumped on the bombers? Was after they dropped their loads then, because the escorts were gone?
Sometimes. In the case of 12 Group, which was based north of London and famously launched big wing attacks on the bombers, mainly this was when they were on the way home after dropping their loads. And there's a great debate about how effective the big wing was. I mean, there was a great argument in the RAF about the effectiveness of this tactic.
That was when you brought up huge amounts and massive...
Five squadrons at once.
All at the same time, rather than setting them out as soon as they were ready.
Correct. Okay. That's correct. The bombing campaign, the London bombing campaign, put the Luftwaffe under severe pressure. The other source of pressure was that as the bombing losses mounted on the German side, Goering made the error, actually, of ordering his fighter commanders, his Luftwaffe fighter commanders, to give close escort to the bombers. Both tactically and both correct tactic point of view, and also from the point of view of the characteristics of the ME-109, the best role for that aircraft was what the Germans called the Freijagd, the free hunt. In other words, roam over the battlefield, find RAF fighters, attack from a position of altitude and speed advantage, dive down. It's what the US Air Force used to call boom and zoom.
Right.
So dive down, attack, and then climb back up again to a...
But now he tied them very closely
now
to the bomber formation.
He tied them closely to the bombers. This played straight into the hands of the defending fighters, both of whom were more manoeuvrable than the ME-109. Mm-hmm. And in the case of the Hurricane, the performance advantage which the ME-109 had over the Hurricane was then of less importance because, of course, the ME-109s were travelling at the same 180-mile-an-hour cruising speed that the bombers were travelling at, which was, you know, only but roughly half their maximum speed. So they had to accelerate to fighting speed, if attacked, before they could do anything effective. And this very much played into the hands of the defending fighters. So the Luftwaffe losses started to rise steeply in September and October. And the bombing campaign did not succeed in making the British sue for peace or materially affect their war effort. At that point, the battle, late October, more or less just petered out. Eventually, the Germans, in desperation, resorted to sending 109s with a 250-pound bomb on board.
Seriously, so they
fighter
used
bomber,
on a fighter, really?
Fighter bomber raid on London because it had become too expensive. You know, the bomber force was exhausted and had been decimated. 1,800 aircraft nearly Luftwaffe aircraft were just destroyed in the battle. Well, of those, something like 600 were 109s, and the rest were basically either Stukas or a handful of 110s, but mostly bombers.
And eventually, I guess round about October, Hitler postponed, effectively terminated, canceled Sea Lion, which was his cross-channel invasion plan.
Correct. Yeah.
And started withdrawing.
That's correct, yeah.
And the important thing to remember is that, I mean, Britain, among other things, was a huge island base yes, which eventually the U.S. and the other allies were able to pour all their troops and material in.
It was an unsinkable aircraft carrier.
Right, exactly. And if you all had fallen, there would have been no such base off the coast of Europe, and reconquering Europe would have been much, much more difficult if it could have, any sort of Western invasion would have been almost impossible.
Yes.
And if I understood you correctly, about 600 young men in their early 20s and their Spitfires and Hurricanes were really all that stood between what was left of the Western democracies and totalitarian regimes on the continent of Europe. I mean, that, the British fleet.
Well, the man who put it best was Churchill.
Right.
Never in the history of human conflict has so much been owed by so many to so few. Even if one RAF pilot remarked that he must have been talking about their mess bills.
That might very well be the case. But I will say at this point, on behalf of all of the Western democracy, certainly on behalf of the United States, thanks to you and your countrymen for having defended us when we were too blind. And it took us so long to get into that fight. But thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Welcome.
And thank you very much, George, for your discussion of this pivotal moment in our history.
Sure. Well, thank you.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. Wasn't that just a marvelous discussion with George Greenfield at the Royal Air Force Museum? I'd loved every minute of it. I'm sure that you did, too. After the break, we'll come back and we'll talk about a different and equally pivotal battle in that remarkable world conflict. So stay tuned. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're talking about that titanic struggle between authoritarianism and Western-style democracy that we call the Second World War. And we're looking at it through the lens of a recent visit I made to Europe with my son, Ben. We just finished talking about the Battle of Britain. Now let's talk about the Battle for Normandy, otherwise known as D-Day. Ben and I did it up right. We got on a boat in Southampton. We went across the English Channel in more or less the same direction that the invading forces did on D-Day. We went to Cherbourg. We stayed overnight. And then the next morning, we took a day-long tour with a fellow named Trevor.
Well, my name is Trevor Standifer, and I run a small but select private company called American D-Day Tours. I'm an American living in Normandy, but I was also made in France.
That's right. In fact, your parents, one of them was from France, one of them was from the United States.
That's correct.
And now you are here, and we're actually in the kitchen of your home with your lovely wife, who has made us a wonderful meal in the midst of a day-long tour of Normandy, and it's been just a great day so far.
Yes, you know, despite 70 years, Stu, the French here in Normandy have not forgotten the sacrifices that were made by our forces here. You can see it with the monuments that you drive along the road. Let's not forget that collateral damage, as it's called today, was done by Allied bombing. And 22,000 French men, women, and children died during the Normandy campaign, which was the time it took for the Americans and the other Allies to break out of Normandy. And we can see this with all the celebrations that we saw this year in June, just two months ago.
That, the 70th anniversary,
yeah,
right, of the invasion.
That people have not forgotten. So, you know, when sometimes people say, oh, the French don't like Americans, you know, I challenge you to come to Normandy and to prove that. If that's right, then I'm wrong. But
I don't know what all those American flags are doing everywhere if they don't like us.
Exactly. They're probably made in China, though.
That may well be. That's a whole topic for another day.
Yes.
Well, let's put it in a little bit of context. In fact, let's start with geography. Eventually, we knew, of course, that the Western allies, the Brits and the United States, were going to have to come back somewhere across the channel. But they decided to attack south into this area called Normandy, due south, actually, of Southampton and London and the southern English coast. And then there's a large peninsula there that juts out into the North Atlantic, and it's called, I can't pronounce it, Cotentin?
Le Cotentin Peninsula, which the French would call it La Manche because it looks like a sleeve.
Right.
The peninsula is 21 miles wide, 34 miles long, and it was vital that we capture the deep sea water port of Cherbourg. And that's why, as you know, we sent in airborne division troops there to secure and have special missions so that when the troops got off from Utah Beach, they could link with them cut across the peninsula and marched their way into Cherbourg. See, the Germans were very good with defending the ports of France, but they made one crucial mistake. All their guns are facing towards the ocean. None of them were facing towards the rear. And that's why Cherbourg fell so easily. That being said, they did have to fight through 20 days of fighting in hedgerows, and I can only explain that to you if you come here in Normandy and see it with me.
Which is what we did this morning. It was a remarkably moving experience as well as a very revealing experience. I mean, certainly getting off the beaches, we've all seen the movies and we've all heard the accounts, and that was an enormous difficulty and an enormous sacrifice. And there was a great advantage. Once we breached that Atlantic wall, as you pointed out this morning, at Utah Beach, then we could attack from behind the German fortifications on the shore. But that wasn't the end of the battle. That was just the beginning of it. And then we went through that almost impenetrable maze of hedgerows that you were kind enough to draw us through today. And I think you made the point, those have been around for centuries.
Yeah, they were an invention by the Normans, whose ancestors were the Vikings, showing up in Normandy in the 8th century, 700s. They were agricultural techniques to prevent the wind from eroding the soil, and they offered good protection, and they were a natural barrier for the animals. Unfortunately, they also prevented 20th century armored tanks, our Sherman tanks, from getting through.
So it took us close to a month to get through those hedgerows, to take Cherbourg, and then consolidate our position on the peninsula. And it was then after that that we'd had to break out and take the rest of France, and that took us some more time. So this was an area where roughly half of the U.S. casualties in the Western campaign took place. And I just learned that this morning.
Yes, of the 76,653, now I'm just giving you the average numbers because I'm sure that British books, German books, French books, even American books have different numbers, but I'm just giving you the approximate numbers. So roughly 76,653 Americans are going to die in World War II, all branches included. But for the Normandy campaign, which is the time it took for us to get out of Normandy, we're looking at 31,744 of them dying here in Normandy.
That is absolutely astonishing. And, of course, we went this morning to St. Mary Eglise. Did I pronounce that correctly?
St. Mary Eglise, the Church of the Holy Mother.
And that's the very famous scene from the movie The Longest Day, where the paratrooper came down and got stuck up on the church steeple.
Yes, played by the actor Red Buttons.
That's right. And they actually have a semi-permanent installation, it seems, of a paratrooper, a mannequin.
They took him down a long time ago, Stu. But, yes, it is a mannequin, and It is a quarter-inch metal wires that have been painted white to look like parachute rope because of wear and tear.
Exactly right. Yeah, but what I thought was fascinating is you pointed out to us that he wasn't actually on that part of the church. He was on another part of the church. So you can learn all sorts of interesting things. And we really, both my son Ben and I, who took your tour this morning, have really, really enjoyed it. Ben, did you have anything you wanted to add about this? No, you want to sit there and be a sullen teenager instead? Okay, that's very good. Ben's very good at that. Okay, well then, if people would like to take your tour in the future, how do they contact you? How do they make these arrangements?
American D-Day Tours is on the web at www.american-dday, and that's spelled DDAY-tours.com, and I'm also on Facebook, American D-Day Tours.
Okay, and they, if they take a tour from you, then the arrangements basically involve getting picked up in the morning, taken around. We saw Utah Beach this morning. And then we're having lunch in your wonderful abode here. And then after that, we're going to go out and see Omaha Beach this afternoon, right?
Well, we're going to see Pointe du Hoc, where U.S. Army Rangers are going to scale 100-foot-high cliffs against unsurmountable odds.
Right.
Then Omaha Beach, and then we will finish off the day by paying our respects to those fallen American soldiers who never got to have a life so that we could.
Thanks so much to Trevor Standifer for sharing that with us. That was just a little taste of what you'd get on one of his tours. You need to go to his website. You need to go yourself. Let's finish up with Ben again, who's going to give a little story that he personally experienced on Omaha Beach.
Our guide would actually, Trevor would actually stand out on the beach, and he would use a pointing stick to make drawings in the sand to show us where the various units came in. And after he had finished giving us this talk and pointed out these various things, you went wandering off by yourself, and at a certain point, you went all the way down to the water.
Yeah, I just wanted to get at the point. I wanted to be in the water, and it was funny. I was running on the beach, and I was trying to avoid little tidal estuaries or whatnot. I didn't want to get wet, and the thought came to me how absurd it was. My obstacle running along this beach is my desire not to get my feet wet, and you're running along this very very long stretch of beach, and you're just trying to imagine what it would have been like to be running on the same beach, under a hail of bullets, with your friends getting taken out left and right, and you know, the so much blood that, you know, the ocean is getting covered red. And so I was running, and I noticed something else was written in the sand, and it was simply it was just a simple message that said thanks, that some other passerby had written. Because, you know, obviously you just get a profound sense of gratitude for the incredible sacrifices that those men made, so that, you know, we can have a constitutional democratic society.
Yep. In fact, Trevor told us a story. He said he had, earlier that year, I think on the 70th anniversary, had brought back an actual veteran of Omaha Beach, and the veteran had brought his family, and at a certain point he had broken down in tears, and it was when he saw people playing on the beach, and everyone of course was very solicitous and was asking him if he was okay, and he said, no, these are tears of happiness. We did this so that those children could play on the beach.
It was very moving. And then afterwards, we visited the American Cemetery.
Yes, yes, that was very moving as well.
Which is, you know, it's maintained by the American government. It's a little bit of a American land in France. And I apologize, I'm paraphrasing a quote by a man whose name I forget, who said simply that, you know, our soldiers didn't come to conquer but to liberate, and the only land we asked for was the land we needed to bury our dead.
Wow, what a moving experience that was. It still brings tears to my eyes to recall it. We're going to end now with a prayer that was given by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt when he announced the D-Day landing. Sadly, we don't have time for the whole prayer, but I think you'll get the gist of it. Here is FDR.
My fellow Americans, last night when I spoke with you about the fall of Rome, I knew at that moment the troops of the United States and our allies were crossing the channel in another and greater operation. It has come to pass with success thus far. And so, in this poignant hour, I ask you to join with me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard. For the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come with rushing speed, but we shall return again and again. And we know that by thy grace and by the righteousness of our cause, our sons will triumph. Lead us to the saving of our country, and with our sister nations into a world unity that will spell a sure peace, a peace invulnerable to the schemings of unworthy men, and a peace that will let all men live in freedom, reaping the just rewards of their honest toil. Thy will be done, Almighty God. Amen.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Trevor Standifer for telling us about D-Day. Thanks very much to George Greenfield for telling us about the Battle of Britain. Thanks to young Benjamin Harris at UVA. Good luck with your finals, Ben. And thanks so very much to Franklin Roosevelt and to Winston Churchill for saving Western civilization. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and, what's that guy's name? Chad Barrett. Yes, Chad as well. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. My name is Stuart Harris, And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.